We're still talking about, you know, the history of the church. And tonight we're going to go from the Great Schism. Remember last week we began with, we picked up from the Ascension, right? And then we went through the Apostolic Era. The Patristic took us up to the year 1054, when there was the split between the Eastern Church and the Western Church, right? So that's where we're going to pick up here at 1054. So we got the split, then between the two churches, and we wind up then, go back out to your world history of what a time it was in the world, right? With just the development of governments and people and invasions and all of that, that was going on. Jerusalem taken over, right? The Turks coming on in here, becomes a Muslim area. And then you wind up with the Crusades, and the Crusades lasted for hundreds and hundreds of years. The mottos out there of fighting for Christ, and this is what we're going to do. But during that same time period, the Crusaders, Western Church really did a number on the Eastern churches, destroyed a lot of the churches and the property that were out there. And it was noted that the Crusaders were deliberately more destructive than the Muslims were. As the Muslims took over that area, they destroyed everything. The Crusaders did, looted everything and carted it all back out, into Europe. Even today they're still talking about some of the items that were taken and restore them back out to all of those various countries. So it was really a situation that we really shouldn't be very, very proud of what had happened. The Crusades themselves later on are going to come back up again to haunt the church, because Crusades are expensive, flat out expensive, and somebody has to go and pay for it, all right? And you can only guess who the heck is going to pay for all of it, right? So we're in the 1100s, high school history books describe that time period as the Dark Ages. What was happening in world history? Roman Empire is declining. You got all of the Goths, the Franks, etc., all coming down. Books are being burnt. All of that history and the culture that was in Rome and in Greece, etc., all just it starts to to disappear. And it was during this particular time that we really do have a lot of the monks, to thank, because they started to go and preserve so much of all of the books and the material, the thinking, of both Roman and Greek literature. It was the monks that started to go and do that. And there's a word that is, carried over into our culture today that's reflective of those time periods where those monks copied down everything and, because there's no printing press yet. It was all done by hand. And it's called a clericalism. Because the clergy up there, the monks, were the ones that were copying everything down. And what came out of that was,
What was that?
The door locked. So that was happening at that point. So while all of those changes are going on, Catholic Church, Christianity is growing stronger and stronger and stronger. Church sends missionaries out into all those new areas that are found to go and spread the faith. And the church itself becomes very, very dominant even in the secular world in making rules and regulations, and who's going to anoint kings and kings with bishops and back and forth. So it was, even though they were at odds in many, many instances, the church always retained the authority to excommunicate kings. Can you imagine that? You know, that, and people acknowledge that the church had the authority on its own, and that the church had real temporal power, had an army. The church, just some statistics for us.
Well, the kings exerted their authority by imprisoning some of these.
It went back and forth, yeah. No doubt about it. But the church was the largest landowner. 25% of all of the land in Europe was owned by the Catholic Church, okay? And the clergy had lots and lots of privileges that the people didn't have, right? The people are basically illiterate, you know? The clergy at this point was becoming more and more literate. Why? And the bishops, because they were coming out of the aristocracy of the area. That's where that hierarchy of the church was starting to go and develop. It said that the church crowned kings, you know, and the kings turned around and tried to go and crown popes and bishops. You know, it's what was happening, you know, at that particular time. But during that particular time also, as we go in through the 1100s and the 1200s, it's the beginning of some of the Christian communities that still exist today. They start to develop. People turned around and started to look at what was happening around them and saying that, you know, something should be done about this. You know, this is, the people are not being addressed. So you wind up then, St. Francis of Assisi in the 1100s, all right, where he's saying this is not the gospel message. Right? And all those stories about St. Francis, you know, standing there in the courtyard and stripping down naked and turning everything back over to his father and says, I renounce everything. And here St. Francis then goes and lives in that little chapel where he believes, you know, in a dream that he has, that he hears the voice of God to say, Francis, rebuild my church. Right? And he takes that to mean this broken down little chapel that he's in, and Francis works like crazy to rebuild that chapel, only later on to go and get a clearer message. Rebuild my church was go to Rome, you know, and let's start to rebuild the church. You know, that's what we need to do. At the same time, you know, 100 years after that, one of the greatest minds in church history pops up onto the scene, Thomas Aquinas. You know, just incredible. You know, everything that has been written, you know, by Aquinas. One of the most well-known, of course, is his Summa Theologica. You know, to attempt and read that, you and I've tried. It is hard because it is written in a scholastic point of view, so that if you have an idea and you want to talk about it, the first thing you do is refute your idea. And you got to come up with all of the ways that my idea is wrong. And then you turn around and say, here's the contra opposite. And you go and start to go and then write what it is that you want to go and get across. Volumes, Aquinas had written. When you take a look at the catechism, when you see any footnotes in there that start talking about Thomism, that's what we're talking about. Came from Aquinas, all right? It was in 1950 when Pius XII turned around and acknowledged that Thomistic philosophy was the surest guide to the Catholic Church. Right? He's back in the 1200s during the same time period. Right? So look at what God does in chaos. You know, so then you wind up with the Franciscans, you know, coming out of that. So time marches on. You wind up with another big deal happening, you know, in the church. Remember, Rome's the seat of the Western Church. But after a while, Rome's not the happening place. Right? Francis. Right? So the Pope decides, right? And it was Pope Clement. He moves the papacy to France out of Rome. And if you want to read about an active woman in the Catholic Church who turned around and changed, turned it upside down, it's Catherine of Siena. Read the story of Catherine of Siena, because she finally turned around and convinced the popes at the time, no, you give up all of the pomp and the circumstance, etc. You belong back in Rome. Rome is the seat of the church. And then she finally convinces them to go back and move the church back out to Rome. It was not an easy experience. Multiple times she had to keep on reminding different popes, you don't belong here, you go back there. Catherine of Siena. You go and read about her. It was Urban VI who finally turned around after he was elected, that he moves the head of the church moves back to Rome. All right, wasn't a real happy time in the church. People didn't like that. France, Italy, Rome, Avignon, and so there was another schism. And the church, there was two popes. Not like we have two popes now, with Pope Emeritus and Pope Benedict, but there were two popes, the church was split. And that lasted for 39 years. And then finally, the church agreed who was the pope, and we had one pope, and it was, back in Rome, all right? So, but the hostilities, between people and governments, et cetera, they just didn't disappear. In the meantime, you still had the Crusades were winding down. You're in debt. They're expensive, right? So there's a great demand for revenue. In the church. One of the things that starts to occur to raise money was indulgences were sold. All right, so that, here you can participate and receive indulgences for different works of mercy, but there's no charge. The church will always turn around and say, no, you don't pay to go to Mass. You don't pay to receive the sacrament. You don't pay, Now, some married couples would certainly say, what are you talking about? It cost me a small fortune to rent the church. They say, you rented the church. You didn't pay for the sacrament, You're not paying for the sacraments. Right? So forgiveness of sins, reconciliation. You were able to go and be charged a stipend, for that. Wrong. Absolutely wrong. But that's what's going on. So you had people on both sides of the aisle, so to speak, that were arguing those points. What's wrong with the church, right? And then, while that's going on, we moved out of the Dark Ages into the Renaissance period. So public thinking really starts to change, right? People start asking a whole heck of a lot more questions. The rediscovery of the Greek and the Roman texts comes back big time. Architecture starts to change. Different ways of learning and teaching begin to change. It's the beginning of even humanism in universities that starts to change. Remember, humanism is this speculative inquiry way of looking at things, asking questions, and starting to form opinions. Starts to go and generate a lot of new ideas in the world, not just in the church, but in the world. And you see reflected in this time period some of the real big names, that we recognize. Leonardo da Vinci starts to emerge at this point. Michelangelo, Raphael, Shakespeare, and St. Thomas More, with his thinking and writing and teaching, starts to emerge. That's all going on during this Renaissance time period. So that thinking then and challenging, the status quo is starting to go and move through everything, and it moves through the church also. And it takes us up to 1517. All of this has been happening between 1054 and 1517. And in 1517, an Augustinian monk, who is plain old challenged by what was happening in the church, still the Catholic Church, just the church. He's challenged by it and recognizes that reforms are necessary. You can't be selling indulgences. You can't. And he starts to tick off all the different things that say, no, this shouldn't be. The church needs reform. And he turns around and he nails those 95 theses onto the church doors of his cathedral. And that was Martin Luther, who turned around and said, this stuff is wrong. It needs to be changed. In my opinion, just my opinion, and I know I'm being taped, my opinion, what I've read about Martin Luther reminds me so much about John the 23rd, when he called the Second Vatican Council, you know, into session, and saying, things need to change. Now, Luther, everything that I've read about him, he did not foresee, desire, want, plan on, initiate, support the split in the church. He saw himself as a reformer, much like John the 23rd. But what winds up happening is the split in the church, right? It's what starts to happen. So you would wind up then with Catholicism and then Protestantism, right? That split starts to occur. So that happens in 1517, you know, initiated, some will say, by Martin Luther. As far as I know, Luther himself would turn around and disagree with that assessment. But as all of that thinking is going on now throughout Europe and then throughout the world, and it leads to other people with other ways of thinking, right? So then you wind up with John Calvin, you know, developing his doctrine of predestination, right? So that's going on. Scores and scores and scores of new denominations spring up around the world. A lot of them are specific to different countries, right? So they start to spring up. And even though you wind up with more denominations springing up in different countries, there was still always that tie between theology and the government. Right? It happened that, you know, that way. So, for example, here's five different countries. You know, that in Germany, Martin Luther is there, and that movement breaks the church away from Rome, and they, you know, create their own. You know, and they name it after Luther, and we wind up with Lutheranism. You know, but Lutheranism, really does follow very, very closely with Catholicism. You know, with the texts and the mass, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't acknowledge the Pope as the head of the church. Switzerland, you wind up with John Calvin, and he develops the whole doctrine of sola scriptura. You know, saying, hey, forget about what that Catholic Church is saying about tradition. If it's not in the Bible, it doesn't exist. You know, and as we talked about so far in all the different RCIA classes, that's far from the case. Originally, there was oral tradition, right? And then later it was written down. So Calvin, how do you turn around and say if it's not in the Bible, it didn't exist when you had it, you know, all as an oral tradition, you know, before that? In France, you know, doctrines of individual faith alone, you know, is what's necessary. Individual faith, you know, forget about a community. You know, community, church, the church, the body of Christ. No, individual, all right? In Scotland, John Knox begins his own church, and he has a Presbyterianism in Scotland, and it leads to a break in Scotland between the North, which he'll retain being Catholic, and the South being Protestant. But it was his way, and John Knox himself was a Catholic priest that, you know, begins his own denomination, his own church. And of course, in England, we know about good old Henry VIII. I am Henry VIII. You know, Catholic. You know, a Catholic king. All his wives, you know, getting divorces from the church, and finally, when the church, you know, says no, and then he says no. Well, we'll just start our own church, you know, and he does. You know, so he starts his own. You know, great movie, A Man for All Seasons. Whew, love that movie too. So what at this time period, there were three major churches, Christian churches, that start to emerge. Lutheran, the Reform, and the Anglican, and of course you had the Catholic Church. Smaller groups start to go and come out of those because there were people in those groups who disagreed with those groups and then say that, no, here's another way to be able to go. So you wound up then with the Anabaptists, who were, they're the basis of the Amish people here in the United States. Unitarians came around. Some people, one of the classes that I was in, I had to write a paper on my own denomination and then pick another to write about, and I chose Baptist. I said, why not? You know, most of the people I met, on the job were all Baptists, might as well learn something. And I would ask them, I'd say, okay, tell me what you believe. I say, remember I told you one of the classes, we could stand up and recite the Nicene Creed. You know, somebody asks you that question, here's what I believe, So I would ask them the same thing, you're a Baptist, yeah, what do you believe? And they would disagree with each other.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, how did you get started? Well, we're part of the Anabaptists, that came out of Switzerland. It's not what I learned, that it came out of England, as Puritans, because Puritans didn't go far enough with the split between at the Catholic Church, so that the Baptists wanted to go even further, in there. So that religious intolerance then between, now it's not just, religious traditions, but countries, all right? And that goes on for another 100 years. Time sure flies when you're having fun, huh? Physical wars break out. Again, this is just high school history. 1618 to 1648, the 30-year wars. People fighting each other because they want the opportunity to worship freely. What a novel idea. I want that opportunity to worship freely. Time's marching on. We split. A lot of controversy over in these years over here. And then the Catholic Church called, as we've seen all throughout here, what's the church's response to schisms and breakups and heresies, etc.? The councils. How do we address this? What do we do? And the same thing comes up here with the Council of Trent is called, called into play. All right. And at the same time, so we had Francis back in the 1200s, now we're in the 1500s, and you got Ignatius of Loyola, right? He turns around, and we're talking about Ignatius and, him just being a really wild guy, wanted to be a soldier, wanted all of the fame, that came along with that, gets hit with a cannonball, laid up in a hospital for a long time, loved reading, all the little booklets about the knights in shining armor, ladies in distress and the damsels and everything. And he read every single one of them that they had in the hospital, and he wanted more to read, and they provide him with a book called The Life of Christ, and he reads that, and it's like, whoa, and he winds up forming a religious order the size of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, right? And then someday we could talk about the history of the Jesuits. They've had their ups and downs, throughout the church. So going through all of this, the Council of Trent is called. It was Paul III who went and called that into existence. There were some people turned around and said it was the counter revolution or reformation. Against Protestantism. So Protestantism itself, at the very word, is protesting Catholic doctrine. So then there's going to be a counter, protest against Protestantism. But, others said that at that point, that all of the reforms that even Luther saw earlier, still existed. And they needed to be addressed. And that's why I think that Luther was so much in thinking similar to John the 23rd. Because when the Council of Trent was called into question, the issues that those bishops had to face at that particular point in time was identify the sacraments. So is it the Council of Trent? There are seven sacraments. Comes from the Council of Trent. The real presence of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist, body, blood, soul, and divinity. The explanation of the Eucharist, bread and wine to body, blood, soul, and divinity, transubstantiation is supported at the council. There were liturgical forms. Money was discussed. Even issues as seemingly as trivial that said that if you're going to be the bishop of a diocese, you got to live in it. You can't be a bishop, and live in Rome and your diocese is over someplace else, some poor place. If you're the bishop of a diocese, you live in that diocese, period, end of conversation. So there were a lot of those reforms that came out of the Council of Trent. So a lot of what we take for granted today, as far as the structure of the church and the sacraments and the teachings, came out of Trent, and that was in the 1500s. The next challenge that came up in the world, it's in the 17th century, and it's called the Age of Enlightenment. Right? Another big challenge for people. I mean, people, we've gone through so much in world history, a lot of discussion, a lot more people, a lot more ideas, a lot more exchange of ideas, amongst people. And one of the things that came out of the church was this idea that of the truth, and that the truth must be sought, that people must seek the truth. And then, of course, that idea and that thinking starts to spread through everything. Education, economic advice, etc. And what flows right out of that is you wind up, again, with John Locke, with his ideas of how to go and educate people. Adam Smith with all of his laws of economics. Isaac Newton comes out of mathematics and physics. So people are being challenged, and they start asking questions, and they start answering those questions and offering answers to those questions. It's the 17th century. What's happening at that particular point in time? Sailing around the world, the new world. We're going to go and all those discoveries that are going on. People, it's not just Europe anymore. Now you've got, the new world, with its own history that we're still, suffering with today. Because lo and behold, when they landed there, I mean, we know that there were people there, And we just, came on in and took it over. But this idea that the truth must be sought was even used by Thomas Jefferson when he starts to draft the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, when he turns around and says, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Look how that thinking starts to change, in the world. I mean, it really is, you start to see that as it goes through and say, boy, that's really something. Christianity spreads like crazy in the New World because all of the exploration was coming out of Christian countries. Portugal, Spain, England, France, sending ships over. Still with that mentality of spread the gospel, spread the gospel, spread the gospel, so that when Isabella takes Columbus and funds him with the three ships and heads on over to the New World, there were friars on those ships to be able to go and be missionaries, to go and spread the gospel into those new areas. I mean, it was just ingrained in people to be able to go and do that. We can look at the United States today, and say, okay, who was where when? Look at the West Coast. all of the towns, you know, Los Angeles, you know, San Jose, all Spanish names, you know, after, you know, church names, you know, and because it was the Spanish Catholic that was out there developing those particular areas. I could tell you that I think it's real interesting that to get a Hagstrom map of the city of New York and look at the street names, and you could go and just from that map identify what country developed what part of New York City just by the street names that is still there today. You'd say, look at this mosaic, you know? And you say, well, no wonder the streets don't even line up because that was deliberate, you know? Not in my area. You're going to stay out and we're going to have the streets going this way in my area. Oh, you can have the streets going your way in your area, you know, to be able to get that done. You know, generally speaking, as people were moving out, you know, to the New World, they wanted a separation between the church and the state. Remember, they had fought the 30-year war, you know, years earlier, you know, because they wanted the right to worship freely. You know, a lot of people, you know, left, you know, Great Britain to come because they wanted to be able to worship freely. I mean, it's like it's so alien for us because we're able to. You know, but for people to give up everything that they had because they wanted to be able to worship freely. So the people come in, they want a separation of the church and the state. But what they wanted was to keep the state out of the church, not the church out of the state. They wanted that separation. Thomas Jefferson, who I really admire, you know, as much as just a brilliant young man, that did what he did, but also what an idiot in so many other respects, you know. But for Jefferson, the Constitution of the United States to him was like a religion. All right, that's what he saw, the outline of a religion. You know, but if he would have had some of his way, you know, we would have all followed Jefferson's religion. Now remember, Thomas Jefferson carried things to such a point that you could buy the Jefferson Bible because he took all the parts out that he didn't like. You know, so he created his own Bible. You know, literally, they said he used two books, cut out the parts that he wanted, and pasted them all back together again, right? So to look at the history of the Catholic Church as we've gone here through Trent, and we come in here into the 1800s, what was happening in the world at that point in time, too, was the influx of people that are moving all around the world. And they're taking different ideas with them also. And that was really, really important, what immigrants were able to go and bring, you know, to different areas. What Catholic immigrants were able to bring to the different areas. A phenomena that happened, you know, in the 18th and going into the 19th century, it was that most of the people that were coming into the United States from all those other countries were all, you know, poor people, you know, Irish people, Italians, etc. So it was all poor people, Catholic poor people, coming into the United States. And as just being poor people, they were discriminated against. And then being Catholic poor people, you know, there was like a double whammy. So that it was one of the reasons why, even for education, when the governments of the time, the cities and the states, turned around and wouldn't let those people into the schools, right? That the Catholic Church comes in and starts opening up parochial schools in parishes to educate people. You know, and they said that the church said that no, you know, to not educate people is wrong. You know, and so then you wound up with the Catholic Church being labeled with that it was the church of the lower classes of society. Well, the lower classes of society. So Catholic schools and Catholic education became a real necessity because of discrimination. The Catholic Church continues to grow in the United States. Why? Look at the influx of all of the Irish and Italians coming into the country. So that's happening. Does it sound anything like today? Catholic Church growing in the United States? Why? All of the Hispanic people, you know? So you wind up with all those Hispanic immigrants coming in that are bringing, you know, Catholicism with them. The church, to her credit, the different priests that were involved, as they are discriminated against, look for opportunities. How are they going to be able to spread the good news? And I think that this is like just part of the Holy Spirit, the Holy Spirit alive and well. How are you going to go out there and spread the good news? So a new invention comes along. And it was the radio. And they jump on the radio to be able to start to broadcast out to people, Catholic teaching, etc. Later on, when it's television, who was one of the very, very first TV evangelists that we had? Bishop Sheen. Right? Boy, I remember Bishop Sheen up there. It was only black and white. It was only later on when they colorized him, got his, you know, with his red robe and cape and everything, you know, out there. But boy, he was riveting. You know, really was. And I feel so fortunate that I had the opportunity twice to be able to go and meet him. You know, once in high school, once in college. And boy, I can tell you that those piercing blue eyes really felt like he was like, looking right through you, you know, when you had your, you know, 13 seconds to come up and say, Bishop, you know, and look up at him and go, oh my goodness, you know, it was really something. So while, you know, the immigration is going on, as it's put over here, the first Vatican Council is called. Right? Wasn't called Vatican I when it was first called. Remember, the councils are named after the city that they were called in. So this was in 1868. So it was a council that was called, that was held at the Vatican. You know, and the purpose of that then was to be able to go and look at four different areas that were affecting the church at that point in time. And that's what Pius IX, why he called it. Because he recognizes that there were areas where the faith was being attacked, so he wanted to get all the bishops of the world together to be able to go and address it. He wanted to address the whole matter of clerical life, what was expected, you know, what about training priests, seminaries, et cetera, et cetera. He wanted that addressed. He wanted the whole topic of Christian education for youth to be addressed. He wanted that. And he wanted to address the relationship between the church, Catholic Church, and the state, with the goal to be, how can that union promote peace? And that's what he wanted that, you know, that council to be able to specifically address. And they started to address it, you know, and 1,000 bishops, you know, attended. They came out and said that there were a couple of things that really needed to be done to educate. They said there should be a catechism, all right? We need a catechism. They wanted a systematic approach to canon law. You know, as Father Bob had mentioned in the first class, how important that is, because it governs what the church does. So that Vatican Council wanted a canon law, you know, and then they also discussed at that council papal infallibility. And of course, what came out of that was, under certain circumstances, matter of faith and morals, and, you know, and we had talked about that, you know, and then with congeliality with the other bishops before a doctrine would be defined as being dogma. And it's happened twice in church history. And, you know, both of them, Marian, the Assumption and the Immaculate Conception. So now while that council's going on, war breaks out. Right? The Franco-German War breaks out. The council is suspended. It was never concluded. Big difference between being suspended and then being concluded. So, ends up 1868, war breaks out, council is suspended. You move over, you know, you come into the, you know, into, you know, the 20th century, and, you know, World War I. right? It becomes a reality. And then we keep on moving through, we're going through, and World War II is there. And then it's in the 1960s when John the 23rd turns around. It was, you know, Pius the 12th dies. A lot of, and I can remember this, I mean, just all of the discussions about who the new pope was going to be, you know, all of the arguments, you know, that were going to be about that. And then John the 23rd winds up being elected with the information being that little old fat guy, you know, who's just going to be a caretaker until we can get somebody really good. You know, he'll kind of be the caretaker pope, you know. And that was the general expectation when John the 23rd was elected. And people could not have been more incorrect, because John the 23rd then turns around and says, we need to be able to go and address what's happening in the church. Right? Sounding so much like Luther, you know, we need to address it. And that's where, and Father Bob had brought this out, you know, on either our first or second class, the image of the church prior to the Second Vatican Council. This is what John the 23rd saw, and what he said, this has got to change, right? That the church was the kingdom of God, period, in the conversation. You know, as Father Bittner would turn and say, if you're not part of the club, you're lost, right? It was based on the hierarchy of the church. You know, that good old triangle, start with the Pope and working down and, you know, down here someplace. Right? The church was a teacher. You know, okay, you want the answer? Ooh, church will give you the answer. You don't have to make up your mind. Church will tell you. Church is a teacher. Right? The laity. Right? What's the role of the laity in the church? Well, the role of the laity is to pray, pay, and obey. You know, that's the model of the church at that point in time. John the 23rd steps up and says, whoa, 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 whoa. We got to change this. And what comes out of that is, you know, another council at the Vatican. Now it's called Vatican II because, you know, 1868 was a Vatican council that was now Vatican I. Then you wind up with Vatican II. And what comes out of Vatican II is that we're pilgrim people. We're on a journey. You know, it's not cut and dry. We're the people of God. You know, with baptism, everything starts with baptism, the gateway. You know, and that we all participate in the priesthood of Christ. And our baptism, we're baptized into the church as priest, prophet, and king. That's our role as individuals. That the church's life is sacramental and scriptural. And that instead of laity, go pray, pay, and obey, the role of the laity now, and this, you know, and I'm saying now, I mean right now, is to full conscious active participation in the life of the church. That's the expectation of, you know, for everyone, you know, in the church today. Full conscious active participation in everything that we do. All right? So sometimes, you know, people turn around, and I'm sure David would be able to go and, you know, and listen to this too and say, oh yeah, full conscious act of participation. You try to get them to sing. You know? Yeah. But that's what we're called to do. You know, full conscious act of participation. You know, in everything that we're going to do. So when John the 23rd calls this council together, and it lasted from 1962 to 1965. I can tell you that at the same time period, you know, me, New Yorker, well, that was the same time period as the World's Fair, all right? And those three crazy towers are still standing over there, too, that were part of Men in Black. They're right there, all right? But yeah, so the World's Fair was going on at the same time. Woodstock, you know, the Revolution, all that's Vietnam. What a time. What a time. And the church, John the 23rd, calls this meeting in Rome, and he wants all of the bishops of the world to attend. So 2,908 bishops do get there. There were 178 meetings over those 3 years. He invited representatives from all of the other Christian churches, both Eastern and Western, to participate in the council. Lo and behold, he invited the laity. So it wasn't just bishops that were there. He invited the laity to have active roles in the council. And horrors of horrors, women too. You know, John the 23rd, you know, 1962. This is what, you know, he wanted. That was his goal. That was his vision. He turns around and he, you know, this committee's put together for to put together the agenda for the meeting. So here he calls this. You know, we're not in a council right now. We're in a synod right now. But Francis is doing the same thing. He's calling people together, and there's all those meetings, you know, and there's, you know, what, and you know, we were to have, and we did. We were given the opportunity for us to have our input, because full conscious active participation of the laity, you know, it's expected, you know, that we are in fact going to do that. So John the 23rd calls people together. He wants them to, you know, he wants to discuss the agenda, you know, for the council. He tells them, here's what he sees, this is what his vision is, this is what he wants to be able to go and do. So they get together, they go into all of their subcommittees, they come back out with their drafts of what they think the agenda should look like, and in their mind's eye, that they wanted to pick up where Vatican I left off. Those same issues that were existing, they wanted to go and address those. And you know, one of the books turned around and said that John the 23rd throws it all out. Everything, the work that they had done, threw it all out and said no. And then he uses the famous words that he wanted to throw open the windows of the church because the church needed fresh air. All right? And it told him to go start all over again. And told him he wants everything in the church examined. You know? So if they had any questions about what does that mean, he told them that the agenda was to be extensive. And the topics range from modern communications, relations between Christian and Jews, the role of the laity, liturgical life, everything he wants to go and have readdressed. The outcome of it was this. All right, I'm going to get back to that. Out of all of the meetings, there are 16 major documents that came out of the documents of Vatican II. I tell you, if you got time to go and the inclination to read them, they are not difficult reading, and they are, wow, wow. You know, some of them we hear about all the time. The dogmatic constitution of the church, Lumen Gentium, as it's called. Church documents, as it was said earlier, like with the catechism, everything, you know, every paragraph has a number. You know, every document is named after the first two words of the document. That's how the document gets its name, all right? So even though it's called the Dogmatic Constitution of the Church, Lumen Gentium, the light of the people, all right? Because that's the way it starts off. There is a dogmatic constitution on divine revelation. There is no new revelation in it. Why not? Because Jesus Christ is the fullness of the revelation of the Father to all of us. The church turns around and takes that divine revelation and systematically starts to go and show us how God reveals himself to us. That divine revelation. It's great. It's a great thing to read, you know. Then there's the pastoral constitution of the church in the modern world. Got them at specs. The church, what they strove for in there was that to leave the documents structured so that they would be there to help for things that they couldn't even foresee. Pretty ambitious. You know, nobody has a crystal ball what the world is going to go out there and look like, but they want to lay out the pathway so that when those different things come up, that they're here. You're going to be able to go back out there to look for ways to be able to go and correct it. I use as one of, I mean, some of the things we had talked about last week, too, you know, that changes that came out of the council, you know, the priests facing the people, doing away with, you know, with altar rails and just things that just became outdated in the church, but the church, you know, hung on to. But this whole idea of the full conscious active participation of the people, that's a biggie. That is a biggie. And then in that Constitution of Sacred Liturgy, you know, to go and look at everything that the church does, you know, and if new translations are necessary, well, then you come up with new translations. So the Roman Missal was revised. And that was, you know, back in the 1960s and published in the 70s, but it still comes out to 2014 with John Paul II saying, that word's not right, right? Go fix it. You know, go get that done. And for us in RCIA, thank you, Vatican II, because it's because of Vatican II that we have RCIA resurrected in the church, right? And what the church fathers wanted to do at that point in time is they went back out to the first century to be able to answer the question, how do we invite new people into the church, into the way, you know, and use first century as the model to be able to go and put together an RCIA program. Well, that was done. So it was reestablished. And I'm happy to say, you deacons, which have, you know, pretty much have never disappeared, but the diaconate became one of the steps to ordination as a priest. So we still have that in the church. So there are, and the men that are on formation to be ordained a priest are first ordained a deacon and then specifically called a transitional deacon because they're transitioning further on to be presbyterate, a priest. You know, the other bunch of men, you know, could be married or single that would be ordained a deacon. And and of course, the deacon's role is to assist the bishop. So then when the diaconate, the permanent diaconate, was reestablished, then men were able to go and go into formation to be ordained a deacon, you know, in the church, given specific responsibilities by the bishop, you know, and to serve the bishop. I'm assigned here to St. Mark's. You know, I work with Father Bob. I report to Bishop Rekha, right? It's a nice relationship with Father Bob. He could tell me to get the heck out anytime he wants, you know? And then I got to go back to Bishop and say, okay, what do you want me to do? You know, St. Mark's is not for me, you know? And then, of course, with Bishop Baker, who I was ordained by, you know, he then turns around and grants me faculties. So I could be an ordained deacon with no right to do anything, all right? So you get those faculties to be able to function, you know, as a deacon, and it's very, very specific what I can do and not to, you know. I got my document. Probably one day I should go and laminate and frame it, you know, of, you know, baptisms, you know, serving at the altar, delivering a homily, reading the gospel, marriages, and being an all-around Mr. Nice Guy. You know, but still working on that one. You know, some things come easier than others. You know. But that happened at the Second Vatican Council. You know, that the diaconate. Worldwide. And the United States really does lead the rest of the world in what the heck is going, you know, what's happening. When I had the opportunity to go to Kenya and I was in formation for the diaconate, you know, had breakfast with the bishop over there and a lot of the priests, and, you know, they had loads and loads of questions about the diaconate. What could I do? What would I not be able to do? How was it, you know, and we talked about that, you know, and a lot of the men that were present said, why don't we do that in our diocese of Nairobi? You know, and I don't know what the heck they've done in the meantime, you know, but just like the Catholic Church with the tribunal office, I mean, just leading the way around the world, you know, and having that available to people, so that when Pope Francis turns around and says, whoa, we got to look at annulments and we got to be able to go and help people around the world with all of these, you know, marriages and remarriages, et cetera, you know, and, you know, the good news is that the United States has done an excellent job of work on in every diocese. And you go to other countries and they look at you like you're cross-eyed and say, you know, it was the case in Nairobi. You do that, you know, and, you know, yeah, you know. So it was very, 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 very different, you know. As I said, the documents on divine revelation, there was nothing new that came out of that. Because a great, great read as to the church's summary of the revelation of God to his people. And then the church in the modern world. Yep.
What's the title of the document on divine revelation?
The official is De Verbum.
De Verbum.
Mm-hmm. So, church in the modern world, Gaudium et Spes. I mean, it is cited, referred to, referenced, held up, knocked down, you know, for the work that that had done. But it addressed, from the church's point of view, the humanity of the world. It wasn't just the Catholic Church, the humanity of the world, especially the poor. Vatican II. So areas then that started to include, and where I'd say, what I think that was just so remarkable, as they start to lay out a framework going forward, not just, here's what we need to do right now, 1965. It's a framework for the future. And they addressed marriage and family, cultures, social and economic life, political communities, war and peace, international relations. I was like, whoa, talk about guided by the Holy Spirit, you know? It was, you know, and living through that was quite an experience, you know? I mean, later on I'll tell you about the crazy relationship with my father and going to Bishop Malloy Retreat House. But during this time period, I'm going on retreats annually, you know, starting when I was 16 years old and going through this. And the arguments and the discussions that would be on retreat between, it was all men on the retreat, you know, and the passionists that were there trying to answer these questions, you know, and you people getting so antsy because, am I getting enough information out of my pastor about what the heck is going on? You know, and the pastor said, well, go read the newspaper. Well, it didn't just have to be the Catholic newspaper up on Long Island. There was, you know, the tablet. You know, I mean, you think about, like, the New York Times and the Daily News and the Washington Post and whole sections on what was going on in the Catholic Church with the Vatican Council. What the heck was going on? You know, more than just the opportunity at the World's Fair to go and see the Pieta, although they put you on a moving sidewalk for that too, all right? You know, so Father Bob talked about, stole my thunder at that first class, when he talked about Avery Dulles with the models of church that Dulles had talked about. And what he turned around, Dulles saw was that there is a model of church as a secular political society, and it's a focus on the visible and the structural nature of the church. What do we do? You know, how does the world view us? How do we impact? What do we do? All right. Dulles turned around and said another model of church is called the Body of Christ model, and it was based on an ancient model of the church, and it stressed what was missing in the political and the political model, and that was the gifts of the Holy Spirit. And Dulles recognized that and said that no, we got to pay a specific attention to that. And then the other model that he had talked about was the sacramental model. How important. Go back out to the Council of Trent, when Trent turned around and said there are seven sacraments. And here, you know, remember the definition of sacrament. You know, outward sign instituted by Christ to give grace. You know, that we Catholics say that there are seven. You know, and that for Dulles, the church is in itself is Christ, and Christ is our sacrament and instrument of wisdom and union with God for the unity of all mankind. You know, Dulles had turned around and said that you, he recognized that because he saw that as a theme that was used all throughout the Second Vatican Council. You know, he recognized it and said that it's very much, you know, what was happening with that particular council. John the 23rd never saw the end of the, never saw it to fruition. He died before that. You know, and then Paul the 6th was elected, and then he wound up with the responsibility to conclude the council and then be able to start to go and implement what was initiated at the council. So the part of me as a deacon, and again, you know, of me permanent, not transitional deacon, is that the clergy is an example of the church in general, but the clergy is to be the servant of the people. The servant. You know, when I was able, when my ordination rolled around in 2018, the prayer card, you know, we were encouraged, you can have a memorial prayer card, you know, for your date of ordination. And what I chose, you know, for the image on the prayer card that I handed out was Jesus washing feet, which I thought was the best example I could think of Jesus's servant, you know. And then this past Easter, Father Bob said to me, "How do you feel about taking half the people and washing their feet and I'll take the other half?" You know? And I said, "Wow, thank you. You know, wow, that's great." And then as we got closer and closer to Easter, he goes, "That bright idea? Can't do it. Pastors are supposed to go and wash the feet of people." I said, "Oh, darn it, you know. Can I pour the water?" You know? So he says, "Yeah, you can pour the water." You know? So he let me go and do that. You know, so I just want to go and leave this with you. I know again went over you know, because see this arrow, I don't have anything else written after that. Because church history is still being written. It's not over, right? There's going to be another chapter someplace down the line, you know, that we're the ones that are going to be participating in that. It's us, you know, full conscious active participation people. That just the explosion in church ministries that came out after the Second Vatican Council is just incredible. Look at our bulletin. Pull out our bulletin and look at it and go pull out a church bulletin, you know, back from 1960. You know, the only people you saw in there that were doing anything were the six priests that were in that parish. All right, lay people do something, forget about it. You know, it didn't happen. Maybe there was a choir director that was a lay person, you know. Other than that, the only other lay people that I can think of that participated in anything was the altar service. You know, certainly weren't lectors, no extraordinary ministers. Didn't happen. All changed with the Second Vatican Council and moving forward. So the concluding comment that I'll have is what was used at the Second Vatican Council itself. And I quote, that the church is both visible and spiritual, a hierarchical society and the mystical body of Christ. She is one, yet formed of two components, human and divine. That is her mystery, which only faith can accept. Amen.